Welcome to The Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Support for The Archive Project comes from Cole Haan, the fashion brand that's acknowledging extraordinary people who write, read, and shape the world through their extraordinary stories. Find these and more at colehaan.com. In this episode, we hear from Colson Whitehead and Yah Jesse in a conversation moderated by Rukaya Adams. These two writers were brought together because both of their most recent books focus on slavery and its legacy, but approach the material and history itself very differently. In The Underground Railroad, Whitehead is not necessarily faithful to chronology and even introduces fantastical elements to create a kind of altered fictional history. As he explains in the course of the conversation, he dispenses with the facts in order to get to the truth, which to me is the clearest explanation of why fiction as an art form is so important and powerful. It gets to a truth in a way that nonfiction can never do. Jesse's book, on the other hand, cleaves closer to traditional historical fiction, but uses a breathtaking sweep of time, telling the story of one family tree over 250 years split by slavery onto two different continents. What matters about both these books, especially when read together, is that they provide the historic context that is so crucial to understanding race in America now. Let's listen.
So we look forward to this conversation. I thought I might start out by telling you what we plan to do. We'll start off with readings by Colson and Yah. We'll have a conversation for a few minutes, and at the end, we'll save some time for questions from the audience. So I thought we'd start with a short reading from both authors, if you don't mind.
Certainly. Thanks so much for having me. This is the very first section of the book, and I wanted to have a sort of an overture of slavery. So this six-page section, I'm going to read the first page, is the life story of Ajari, Cora's grandmother. The first time Caesar approached Cora about running north, she said no. This was her grandmother talking. Cora's grandmother had never seen the ocean before that bright afternoon in the port of Ouida, and the water dazzled after her time in the fort's dungeon. The dungeon stored them until the ships arrived. Dahomian raiders kidnapped the men first, then returned to her village the next moon for the women and children, marching them in chains to the sea, two by two. As she stared into the black doorway, Ajari thought she'd be reunited with her father down there in the dark. The survivors from her village told her that when her father couldn't keep the pace of the long march, the slavers stove in his head and left his body by the trail. Her mother had died years before. Cora's grandmother was sold a few times on the trek to the fort, passed between slavers for glass beads. It was hard to say how much they paid for her in Ouida, as she was part of a bulk purchase. 88 human souls for 60 crates of rum and gunpowder, the price arrived upon after the standard haggling in Coast English. Able-bodied men and childbearing women fetched more than juveniles, making an individual accounting difficult. The ship was out of Liverpool and had made two previous stops along the Gold Coast. The captain staggered his purchases rather than find himself with cargo of singular culture and disposition. Who knew what brand of mutiny his captives might cook up if they shared a common language? This was the ship's final port of call before they crossed the Atlantic. Two yellow-haired sailors rowed Ajari out to the ship, humming, white skin like bone.
Colson, if you don't mind, will you tell us what the story is about?
Sure. I think I, like a lot of people, when they first heard of the Underground Railroad, in say fourth grade or fifth grade, pictured a literal network beneath the earth, like a subway. And then my teacher, of course, told me that's not how it happened. It's a little bit impractical. But it seemed like that could be a cool, interesting, weird premise for a story. But that's just a premise, so I quickly added that complicating element of each state that our hero goes through as she moves north through South Carolina, North Carolina, and et cetera, is a different state of American possibility. And I guess the comparison that came naturally to me was like Gulliver's Travels. So each state is a different island of American possibility, an alternative America that might have been.
Really interesting. Yeah.
Yes.
Will you read a bit to us and then tell us what your story's about?
Sure. First of all, thank you so much for having me. This is my first time in Portland, actually.
Well, you know, we only reign for people we really love.
Yes. Yeah. So I've heard, yes. I'm just going to read from the opening. The night Afia Otre was born into the musky heat of Fancy Land, a fire raged through the woods just outside her father's compound. It moved quickly, tearing a path for days. It lived off the air. It slept in caves and hid in trees. It burned up and through, unconcerned with what wreckage it left behind, until it reached an Ashanti village. There, it disappeared, becoming one with the night. Afia's father, Kobi Otre, left his first wife, Baba, with the new baby so that he might survey the damage to his yams, that most precious crop known far and wide to sustain families. Kobi had lost 7 yams, and he felt each loss as a blow to his own family. He knew then that the memory of the fire that burned, then fled, would haunt him, his children, and his children's children for as long as the line continued. When he came back into Baba's hut to find Afia, the child of the night's fire, shrieking into the air, he looked at his wife and said, "We will never again speak of what happened today." The villagers began to say that the baby was born of the fire, that this was the reason Baba had no milk. Afia was nursed by Kobi's second wife, who had just given birth to a son 3 months before. Afia would not latch on, and when she did, her sharp gums would tear at the flesh around the woman's nipples until she became afraid to feed the baby. Because of this, Afia grew thinner, skin on small bird-like bones with a large black hole of a mouth that expelled a hungry cry which could be heard throughout the village, even on the days Baba did her best to smother it, covering the baby's lips with the rough palm of her left hand. "Love her," Kobi commanded, as though love were as simple an act as lifting food up from an iron plate and past one's lips. At night, Baba dreamed of leaving the baby in the dark forest so that the god Nyame could do with her as he pleased.
So tell us about your story.
Sure. So Homegoing is a novel that follows the family lineage of two half-sisters. Afia, who I just read from, the first half-sister, is the wife of the British governor of the Cape Coast Castle, which is a slave fort that still stands in Cape Coast, Ghana. And Essie, the second half-sister, is kept in the castle as a slave before being sent to America. And the novel just kind of moves back and forth between the two sides of the family, following the descendants for about 250 years of Ghanaian and American history and ending in the present day.
So yeah, can you tell me what about slavery and the framework for slavery drove your ideation and writing? Very interested to know why you started there.
Yeah, I started where I started because I took a trip of the Cape Coast Castle. I went there to Ghana in 2009 to conduct research for this novel. And while there, I took the tour that they give to anyone. And the tour guide started to talk to us about how the British soldiers who lived and worked in the castle used to marry the local women, which was something that I hadn't heard before. And then from there, he took us down to see the dungeons. And I was very struck kind of immediately by that juxtaposition, the idea that there could be these free Ghanaian women walking above these captive Ghanaian people. And so that was really the first inspiration for this book, was having a novel that could kind of show those two sides.
And the decision to have 300 years worth of history covered is pretty ambitious.
Yes.
What was the motivating factor for that period of time, right?
Yeah, that came a little later. I mean, I always knew that I wanted to write kind of about the legacy of slavery, so not just what it was like in 18th century Ghana, but kind of what it has left us today, both Ghanaians and Americans. But initially, I thought that I would do that by having a much more traditionally structured novel, one that took place in the present and then just flashed back to 18th century Ghana. But as I worked, I realized that I was actually a lot more interested in being able to kind of follow the changes that slavery and colonialism made really subtly over this very long period of time. And that's kind of how the structure came about and how the novel just kind of snowballed from there.
Over 300 years.
Yes.
So Colston, your novel is set in a smaller time period and wanted to talk a little bit about why you focused on slavery and what your thought process was in the early stages of writing.
Sure, I mean, I had those two elements. One, the railroad is real, and then each state is a different alternative America. So that allowed me to sort of make the book not so much about slavery, but race and American history, in playing with the different characters and cultures of these different states. It allowed me to put different historical events in conversation with each other, and so, for example, when she goes to North Carolina, it's a white supremacist state, inspired partially by the story of Harriet Jacobs, who wrote a famous slave narrative about running away from her master and then hiding in an attic for 7 years until she could get passage out of North Carolina. And so my North Carolina borrows from her story, but also Nazi Germany. You think of hiding in an attic, Anne Frank. How can I make this story not so much only about black oppression, about Jewish oppression? And so in the way the North Carolina section works in my book, they've solved the problem of slavery by outlawing black people. And if you're caught, you'll be lynched. And I was borrowing from the rhetoric of white supremacists in America, from Nazis. And so I get to put the oppression of black people in America and juxtapose it with the oppression of Jews in Nazi Germany and see what happens, and borrow from, say, the history of Oregon, which was founded as a white separatist state where black people weren't allowed to live or own property or work in the state when it was founded. And so how can I take different parts of American history, German history, and put them in a conversation with each other?
Yeah, this is a stop on the Underground Railroad, right?
Well, I guess you couldn't really hang here if you came here until 1926. I guess you asked me to read, and I was like, should I read from my book or from actually the Oregon State Constitution in 1859?
Right. Yeah, you're the period that Cora spends in the attic was transformational for me to read. One of the concerns I had reading it as an African American and having heard the description of the book before I actually read it was that there was some fantastical, mystical part of the story. And so much of what I read was similar to what I'd read in slave narratives and what I know about slavery as an African American and a student of African American history. So I'm curious to know, other than the fact that there was actually a train running in the underground, how do you have conversations with people who don't know much about the history about what was fantastical in your story versus what?
Sure,
what
I mean,
was
I don't
part of your
feel
research?
It's my. A lot of people are going to Google, after they read the book. Like, didn't the Tuskegee syphilis experiment take place much later than 1850, which is sort of like the ballpark year for the book? I don't feel it's my duty to over-explain what's real and what's not real in the book. I think in altering history, as I do in the book. Well, I guess two things. The first section is very realistic, and before I started deforming reality, I wanted to actually have a historically accurate book that deals with slavery, how it actually was, to honor and testify for my family who lived and died in Florida or Georgia, I don't know. That part of most of my family's history is lost in the black hole of slavery. But before I started playing with reality, as I do later, I wanted to get it right. And then I felt it was okay to change things, and my rule was that I'm not going to stick to the facts of what happened, but I'll stick to the truth. And so by not sticking to what actually happened, I was able to get at a larger American truth by by moving things around. And so even if it's, everything seems off and you're not sure when the government started sterilizing people of color, immigrants, the feeble-minded, it didn't happen during slavery, but seems as if it could have, because the brutality and the oppression of the black body is similar in slavery and later.
So what is the reality that you think you deformed? Because so much of it, to me, was beautiful historical fiction. In reading, I was like, this seems pretty close. So what do you view as the author, as the thing that you deformed?
Well, I think I didn't intend to comment on the present, but if you read a slave narrative and read about slave patrollers who were like the constables, before there was a police force in the South, the slave patrollers would go into plantations, the homes of free black people, and demand to see their papers. And are they allowed to move around, check their IDs, and if you didn't have your papers, you'd be beaten, taken to jail. If you ran away, you could be shot. And the language that slaves use to describe the slave patrollers is the same way I would describe being stopped and checked for my ID, stopped and frisked, pulled over, you know, handcuffed, as has happened to me and happened to a lot of people of color. And so I wasn't really trying to get at anything. It's all sort of right there. I didn't have to force comparisons between law enforcement in 1850 and 2015. The language that I would use to describe my experience is the same way a slave would describe his or her experience with a slave patroller.
Yeah, that's why the attic chapter was so penetrating for me, was in addition to the experience of the slaves, the audience in the town watching the lynching and murders of slaves made me think about Walter Scott in particular, and think about what happened in Minneapolis and in New York. And so I know it would have been difficult for you to anticipate the timing on the release of the book, but it did challenge me to really think about whether we were the townspeople watching the lynchings that were so devastating to read about in the book. So I'm not sure you intended to do it, but it really did make me reflect on how similar some of the experiences and people would be outside of the protagonists in the book, right? Just the bystanders.
Well, I mean, you know, technology becomes a way of preserving those moments of horrific violence. I think an early use for the postcard, the picture postcard, for some people was commemorating a lynching. And so there are a lot of postcards from the 1870s with a black person hanging or, you know, burnt to death, and there's a white crowd watching. And on the back, it's like, wish you were here. You know, we lynched that Sambo last night. Anyway, see you at Christmas or whatever. So, and then, of course, now with the, you know, looking at, I think, television in the 50s that allowed people to see how civil rights protesters were being treated and abused. Early camcorder technology allows us to see Rodney King being beaten, and now everyone has their little testifying device in their pocket and allows us to implicate us in these sort of moments of horrific racial violence.
Yeah, that chapter was beautiful. So thank you for that time. I couldn't tell in reading it whether you spent more time writing it. I thought about you a lot in that process. Like, did you write some chapters really quickly and then have to slow down as you wrote this chapter?
The writing of the book came really, really quickly, and I don't go back to that section a lot when I reread my book. So maybe I was trying to get away from it as quickly as possible.
Yeah, one of the really interesting things about reading the books back to back is that I viewed both of you as having a female hero, not just female protagonists or story drivers. I wonder, did you think about writing this from a daughter's point of view or from a mother's point of view? Because there was a theme about, I'd say, womanhood and motherlessness and yearning that I felt throughout the book.
Yes, I absolutely thought about writing this from a mother's point of view. I mean, first of all, because my people, the Akan people of Ghana, are matrilineal, I knew that if I was going to have a book about, you know, the generations of a family, I wanted to start it with the mothers. And kind of, you know, going back to that trip to Ghana and the idea of these women, both the wives and the captives, I thought it just made sense to kind of to think about it through the lens of women and what their experiences might have been. Obviously, the book has 14 characters and half are men, so I did go into male lives as well, but it felt right to start with the women, to start with the mothers.
Well, so as an African American, I was really fascinated that you picked up a slight twist in that, in the moments when African slaves realized they were in an emerging new culture in the West. So that moment, you fictionalized the moment of the recognition of something new, that there's something brand new being created. And on the matrilineal concept, I was fascinated that you picked up that African-American culture is patrilineal because of the social structure that our culture came to be, but it's matrifocal. Mm. So that in the stories of the two sisters seem to play out. So I wonder, did you tease that out intentionally, or was it just something you picked up in having lived in Alabama?
Yeah, I don't think that piece of it was intentional. I think it was kind of, you know, just as I was writing, making connections between the different families and also trying to kind of reflect the African side to the African American side and thinking of ways that I might do that because I was focusing on women in the beginning.
And so you moved to the United States at what age?
I was 2 when I came to America.
2. And then lived the bulk of your childhood in Alabama?
Yeah, so we moved around a lot when I was young. I lived in Ohio, and then Illinois, and then Tennessee, and then Alabama. And I moved to Alabama when I was 9, and then stayed there until I left for college.
Mm-hmm. And so if this is a family conversation, so one of the interesting tensions, I think, for Africans and African Americans is that there's a conversation that we have to have about slavery. Mm. And it feels like you're helping us have that, to have that. Did you feel compelled to do that as someone who stands, it feels squarely in both cultures?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think so much of the impulse that drove me to write this book was kind of feeling as though I was never Ghanaian enough for Ghanaians and never, you know, never American enough for Americans and kind of walking in that liminal space between the two. And then thinking about what connected the two cultures. And you know, I think to do that, you have to go back a long way and go back to the history of slavery. And at least for me, growing up, my family never really talked about slavery, certainly never talked about Ghanaian complicity in slavery. And yet, I was living in this state where the effects of slavery are still so strongly felt. And so I felt this absence. You know, if I go to school and somebody calls me the N-word, and then I go home and tell my parents about it, and they're just like, that word means nothing to us. You know, how do you kind of have those conversations within your family when they're not kind of used to thinking about slavery and its legacy?
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the reasons why that matrifocal, patrilineal twist is important is I found the thought of losing my mother to be the most haunting loss imaginable for an African American, because there's the breakup of the family in slavery, and the one connection I'd say the modern identity has is to the mother, to the bottom of her stew pot, right? Mm. So when you framed it from the start as the search for mother, for love and yearning, with a yearning that comes with not having it, did you know that you're putting your finger on that bruise and fear that was at the center, I think, of African American culture?
Yes, I think so. I mean, I think one of the great tragedies of slavery is the way that it fractured families in these really irreparable ways. And for so many of the people, it's not just the loss of the mother, but also the loss of your child. I think one of the aspects of this book that many people have told me has been like very difficult for them to kind of grapple with is you know, moments like in Nessa's chapter when she has to leave Kojo for his own good, you know. So these ways that families were ripped apart, I think, was something that I was thinking about quite a bit.
Yeah, that motherlessness, Colson, I with Cora is a theme that floats throughout the book. Did you focus on that ahead of time? Was that a part of your plan for writing, or did it come out in the creative process?
Well, yeah. Sometimes you make a decision and it sort of pays off. I like to mix things up from book to book, and so if I have a third person narrator in this book, maybe have a first person narrator. If this book is funny, maybe have the next one be depressing and grim and make people feel bad. So I had a string of male meditative narrators, and so over the years, you know, in the back of my head when I was thinking of the book, the protagonist was a guy. It was a guy looking for his wife who'd been sold off, a father looking for a child, and then I hadn't really tackled a mother-daughter relationship before. I hadn't had a female protagonist in a while, so it seemed a worthy challenge. And then, you know, one of the first slave narrators I read, I mentioned before, was Harriet Jacobs, and early in her book, she mentions when she hits puberty, like, now I entered the most terrible time for a slave girl, because now you're prey for your master's desires, other male slaves. You're supposed to have babies, to make more hands, pick more cotton, to have more bodies to sell, and so you become particularly dehumanized by slavery in a different way that men were. And so that just seemed worthy of taking on.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you opened the door. I'm going to walk right through it, Coulson. Some of the scenes of sexual violence. So did you do research on what it was like, other than Harriet Jacobs' writing, or how did you get into the writing, you know, as the female protagonist?
Well, I think any protagonist, you have to get into their head. And so the task is always difficult. Just doing the research, I can't say many or most, but rape was a regular occurrence on the plantation, and just in being realistic, it's one of the common brutalities of the slave experience, and so it had to go in the book. And you know, the more I researched, the more I would get more despairing over what I'd have to put Cora and other characters through just in the name of realism. I had another idea for how to shape that. The first plantation scene was basically having it psychologically realistic to me as someone writing in 2015. And we have a notion of what trauma does to you and PTSD, but obviously a slave is being traumatized every minute of their lives and they're not post anything. So making a psychologically credible plantation, a psychologically credible Cora for me was important. And what happens to her in the plantation, in the way that all trauma does, determines all of her human interactions. It determines how she envisions freedom, what that freedom will be. Can she get close to people? What happens if someone opens up his heart to her? Can she do the same thing? And so making that decision to follow through determines all of her interactions with everyone in the book and the hope she has for herself and the possibility she's allowed to keep in her head.
So she has a violative experience early on as a young woman. And at the end of the book, there's a point where she is involved with someone that she cares much about, and there's consent. As a woman reader, the tension between those two experiences was, I felt it throughout the book, that I lived in fear of her violation. Did you intend to have that bookend in her sexual experiences?
It's part of, you know, a slave is an object. You're a tool, you're a piece of property, you're not a human being. And what I wanted to narrate is becoming a person. And so as she goes from state to state, her ideas of herself get bigger and bigger, and then they're frustrated by circumstances. But she's on a journey to becoming a person when she starts off as an object. And so part of that is allowing yourself to have feelings and becoming a real person in the world. So that's important for me to try and dramatize that in a realistic way. It made sense to me.
Yeah, another interesting point of where I'd say the theme was desecration and consent was the times that people met native populations in your book. So it seemed that you were making a connection between the slaves and the taking of their bodies and the taking of the land from natives. What brought you to include that in the story?
Well, I mean, I was trying to be a good humanist. I think the oppression of black people is the oppression of women, is the oppression of Jews, is the oppression of Native Americans. And by making that structural decision early on, I'm allowed to, by not sticking to the facts, I can get to this larger truth. And so people say, like to say it's a cliche, that slavery is America's original sin. I think the original sin is actually coming here and stealing people's land and trying to kill them. So slavery comes in second.
Right, yeah. So did you think about the interface as the story of the American family continued on, the interface with other populations in the United States? Was that a part of your thinking process? So how did you map out the major landmarks in the story?
Yeah, I wrote kind of without an outline, but with a family tree. So that looked a lot like the one at the beginning of the book now, except mine also had dates and then one thing that was happening politically, historically in the background during that time period. So something like the Fugitive Slave Act or the Yasantwa War. And then in other areas, it was much broader. So for H's chapter, I just had Jim Crow / Reconstruction. And so some of the chapters felt a little bit more exploratory than the others, and in that I had to kind of research my way into a story rather than having, you know, the character react to something that I already knew I wanted them to kind of be in conversation with.
Mm-hmm. One of the interesting things about reading the books back to back was that yours was a longer time period, and it felt as if the moment that the book ended with Cora, she was sent into peril in your story. And the part of the book about the days after freedom, when a lot of slaves were captured and ended up being prison labor, really hurt. So tell me about the research for that part of the book and why you chose that as an important historical fact.
Yeah, when I got to H's chapter, I knew a little bit about him in that I knew I wanted him to be, you know, living during this time period in the South.
The point where I shut your book and I turned it over and I walked away from you. You broke my heart.
Yeah, he's a hard one, I think, to read, and certainly was one of the hardest for me to research. Having given myself such a broad topic, Jim Crow and Reconstruction, I didn't really know how to narrow him down, I guess. I thought it'd be interesting just to kind of learn a little bit more about what professions somebody might have right after Civil War, when it's finally possible for you to have a profession. And so I was doing a little research around sharecropping and then ended up with this Douglas Blackman article from the Wall Street Journal many years ago. I can't remember exactly what it was called, but it was about convict leasing in Alabama, something like the Cruel Partnership. And so I read that article and I was so just kind of taken with it and taken with this idea of convict leasing and also just the fact that I didn't really learn about it in school at all, even though I did most of my schooling in Alabama, which is one of the places where this practice took place. And so immediately from there, I just kind of started reading more and more about convict leasing and black prisoners and their world, and a book by Mary Ellen Curtin and other books like that that kind of gave me a landscape for what he might have been dealing with, and wrote the chapter from there.
That was one of the chapters that really, in your book, gave me a mirror to the present. Mm. So to the work of Michelle Alexander,
right,
and then the documentary 13th that just came out.
Right.
So were you inspired by the research or the sort of public conversation that we're having about the prison system and the economic consequences of that?
I wasn't initially. You know, I had just kind of followed this article down a rabbit hole and didn't really pop up to think about what was going on in the present. But I think after I finished a first draft of the book, I did read The New Jim Crow and obviously started to see these parallels. And so much of what we talk about when we talk about the criminalization of black men, I think, has roots in this very early practice of criminalizing black men for things like standing outside at night. You know, just like
sounds
ridiculous.
Pretty familiar, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And so there are so many moments in this book where you can kind of, when you can kind of hold a mirror up to the present, that I think is really, really fascinating, and one of the things that I hoped that the book would do.
What are some of the other things you hope the book would do?
I mean, I think for me, this book is so much about the fact that a lot of these things, a lot of the issues that we are dealing with in the present, particularly issues around racial justice, they don't appear out of nowhere. You know, there has been groundwork laid for them over the course of many, many, many years. And it's important to kind of not take things out of context and just start to believe that we're living kind of divorced from history, because we aren't. And so this book was a chance, I think, for me to kind of trace that long line of history. Mm-hmm.
So, Colson, there was a point in the early part of your book that you described the cost of the slaves and that the slaves were aware of how much they were being traded for. Did you do research on the number that you used for the value of the slave?
Well, it's different in 1790, different in 1850. So I did. I think in that first section that I actually read, it's impossible to figure out how much 35 slaves would be. How many guns would that buy? How much rum? And so it varies. I mean, it's over the 100 years, and it depends. It's different in Virginia. It's different in during the high cotton era. So.
Yeah, you broke my heart in that one, Colson. And the many heartbreaks in that. This sort of dovetails with what Yah was saying about the present, echoing some of the groundwork that was laid 300 years ago. But some of the work that I've done is on slave valuation and. At emancipation in D.C., slave owners were given a tax credit for emancipated males, and it was about $300. And all of the numbers in your work from a period right before that hovered right around that. And what I've learned recently in the last few years is if you take that $300 and grow it to present, it's almost exactly what the net black family wealth is today.
Wow, that's great.
So when I read those pages, I just was like, oh, this just hurts so much at how flat the value of the black body is in our economic system. Mm-hmm. So again, both of you are echoing, I think, something from the past continuing to play out in the present, not just in the way we live, but in our financial lives as well. So that was an occasion where I closed the book and had to walk away from it.
Sorry, that was page one, so certain. Yeah.
So what do you hope people get out of the experience of reading the book and reflecting on it?
Yeah, I mean, I don't have any particular hopes. You know, hope it's worthwhile that you spend your time in it. I think for me, I'm always trying to figure out, depending on the book, I'm trying to figure out something about myself or how the world works. And then I'm hopefully doing it in a way that other people can, if I get the sentences right and the pacing right and the paragraphs and the characters, other people can come along in that journey. So because I am dealing with different sort of semi-forgotten corners of American history, if I can bring people to Google so they can Google what actually happened with the Tuskegee syphilis experiment, or they can take out a book, even better, I think that'd be nice.
Well, one of the things that the both of you hit, and I think is another theme in African-American culture, is this conversation between impermanence and itinerancy and sojourning versus a yearning for permanence, right? So your story is literally people moving around the country, the Great Migration, the sort of tumbling forward, trying to find life and live a free life. And then yours, the story of Cora literally running toward freedom and evolving as a person. That's a pretty powerful cultural theme, I think, for African Americans. Did you think about that as you were writing your stories? Were you intending to break my heart in reading?
Well, it's I wasn't thinking about you specifically. Is there a place where we could be safe? I think that's part of a slave escape narrative. Whether it's in Massachusetts or New York or Canada, is there a place where I can actually be a human being? And then you find the courage to take that first step off the plantation and follow the full moon and run north. And so just pulling back to just the human need for a place of safety, I think we're all trying to find a place where we can be ourselves and be whole. And for different people, it's different cities and different occupations. But I think there's that human need to finally find a place where we can call home and be ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, your story was a journey, a giant journey of lots of people. And then you've experienced that journey personally. Did you think about this tension between the sojourn and craving permanence?
Yes, I think going back to my childhood and thinking about the fact that I moved around so much and questions of home and what home is for a people who have been ripped away from their home, I think really motivated this book. And not just a place where you can be safe, but also a time where you can be safe, because so many of these things that we see in homegoing continue and they recur. And there's a moment in this novel where one of the characters is walking back to his mother's apartment during the Harlem riots of 1964. That riot so echoes, I think, so many of the uprisings that we've seen in recent times. And so this question of things that recur, patterns, was certainly something that was on my mind, as well as displacement and home and longing. And yeah.
I'll be very interested to see what you write next.
Me too.
So I think we are at the time that we've allotted for audience questions. I see we have two microphones. Are there any questions from audience members? Okay, you're up.
Hi, my name is Danielle, and I'm a young creative, and I find that as I've been, I guess, coming into my own and figuring out who I am, I constantly experience this conflict of, or more like an obligation to talk about slavery and my heritage versus questioning if it's really what I want to write about or make things about. And I just wonder if you, any of you experience that kind of like duty to talk about slavery and the long history of oppression of Black people. And how do you deal with that conflict if you experience it?
Yeah, I think it's kind of cliche for a Black writer to talk about slavery. It's sort of sitting there as a big topic, and I think we're expected to address it. It took me 8 books to address it. In terms of writing about my experience, I think definitely when you're forming your identity, you feel pressure to represent, and it's self-imposed and imposed by the gatekeepers of identity. I think if you want to just write about gardening, you can. Just because you're African American doesn't mean you can't be a great writer of gardening books or love poetry. I think you should, as an artist, you should write whatever you want to write and don't get hung up on some weird voice in your head or other people's voices, and do what makes you feel happy.
Yeah, and I think also just follow your interests, and if that goes towards slavery, then that's great, but if it doesn't, that's also great. You just just write the thing that you want to write and worry about who reads it and what it means, all of that later,
This is a question for Yah. I'm curious about the sections of your novel that are set in Ghana and how much of that came from research or how much from stories from your parents or other family members.
Yes, most of it came from research. I was really hesitant, I think, to do any kind of genealogical research into my own family's history, just because I didn't want to feel beholden, I guess, to the truth in any way. The pieces that I did borrow from is, again, I'm a Khan, my mother is Fanti and my father is Ashanti, and those are the two ethnic groups that I focus on. But aside from that, I tried to kind of leave it to research and fiction.
I was curious, as a writer, when you're writing something that is so powerful and personal, in a way, even if they're fictional characters, how do you find self-care for yourself when you're writing and you're researching and you're sort of pulling these stories that really are coming from truth?
Yeah, for me, I don't. I feel, I guess, a little bit distanced when I'm writing. Like, I don't. I don't feel like overwhelmed with the weight of what's happening to my characters as I'm writing. I think the more difficult aspect of this book was the research, because that is where you're kind of constantly encountering truth, whereas at least at the end of my writing day, I could console myself with the fact that this is fiction and that it's all being made up. I couldn't do that when I read these research texts that I was reading. And so, part of, I guess, what I did to care for myself was just to make sure that I wasn't spending my entire day working on this book, you know, that I gave myself the 3 hours and then I went on and did other things that had nothing to do with slavery at all after that.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I found a narrative voice that allowed me to be in the situation with the characters, but also distance enough to shape the material. So I found that voice early on, so that helped. And then, you know, like at 3 o'clock, I do most of the cooking, so I just like figure out what to make for dinner that night. And I come up from my office and I make dinner for the fam and I'm out of the world. So that's my self-care, reading Sam Sifton in the Times and making the chicken tagine or whatever.
Now, that's an interesting question. The same question was asked of the architect of the African American History Museum. He's, I think he's West African. And he said that researching the history was heavy, but then he tried to detach himself so that he could design the actual space. So that's an interesting point of carrying it while you're understanding and then letting it go once you start to execute.
Yeah. Question for Mr. Whitehead. You mentioned that you had been stopped and perhaps frisked. I wonder if you would be willing to tell us any more about that and what your feelings were at that time.
Well, I mean, I think it happens to most young men of color. You're walking down the street, you're driving, and you know the police stop you and want to know why you're in this neighborhood or what you're doing on the street when you're actually just standing outside. In my case, I was buying a beer with some friends. I was 16 in a supermarket, and a policeman came to the supermarket and pulled me outside and handcuffed me. And there's a white lady in the back of his police car, and she said, "No, that's not him," and then handcuffed me and let me go. I guess she'd been mugged a few blocks away, and I was the first, or I don't know, actually I know if it was the first, but I was a young black male in the vicinity. So luckily she wasn't like one of those, they all look alike types. But that's pretty standard operating procedure for a lot of a segment of law enforcement and a common experience for people of color.
And your feelings at that time?
Shock, humiliation, also don't want to get busted for buying beer.
I have just recently read The Underground Airline. I just kind of wanted your guys' thoughts on telling the slave narrative if maybe you're not African American or a person of color, because I didn't realize that it had been written by a white man, and then I sort of had a backtrack of, I'm not sure.
The book Underground Airlines is a sort of alternative history about the railroad and written by a very nice white individual named Ben Winters. And so can you write about people who aren't you? I'm a male writing with a female character. People say she seems realistic. I think if you use your empathy and intelligence, you can write about anything, and then if you fail and are criticized, like Lionel Shriver or something, you should take the hit and try to do better next time.
So, but a follow-up to that question, Toni Morrison, when she talked about writing Beloved before it was widely acclaimed, said that she was writing for Black people in her writing. So the flip side of that question is, you know, were you writing for a specific audience? There were times when there are subtleties in each of your books that made me feel like you were writing for me, that I could hear Toni Morrison's directive in there. Do you think about who you're writing for?
Well, when I first started writing, I thought my ideal audience would be like a 16-year-old Rudo Black eye who would come to the book and think, oh, maybe I can write fiction. In the same way that when I was reading the Dark Phoenix saga in the X-Men, 1981, I was like, oh, I want to write comic books. Or when I read Carrie by Stephen King, I was like, oh, I want to write horror stories. And then my first book came out, and I looked in the audience, and I didn't really see any weirdo Black kids who were 16. And my audience changes from book to book. My last book was about poker, and more people came aboard for that. And Oprah liked this book, so more people came aboard for this one. So I don't think about the audience. I think about... Hopefully, I'm getting what's in my head onto the page, and then different people come to different books for different reasons.
A Morrison quote that I love is the one about how if you're at your bookshelf and you're looking for a book that you really want to read and you can't find it, then you have to write that book.
Right.
So for me, that's what Homegoing was. It was, you know, it's the book I wanted to see in the world, the book that kind of asked and answered a lot of the questions that I had when I was 15 and thinking about race and identity and those kinds of things. So I think it's important to kind of write the book that speaks to you and what you want to see in the world.
Portland, please join me in thanking Colson and Yah.
That was Colson Whitehead and Yah Jesse in conversation at Wordstock, Portland's book festival in 2016. The Wordstock 2017 lineup has just been announced. The festival will take place on November 11th in downtown Portland. For more information about the author lineup, schedule, and tickets, visit literary-arts.org. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear more from the Archive Project, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Support for the Archive Project comes from Cole Haan, the fashion brand that's acknowledging extraordinary people who write, read, and shape the world through their extraordinary stories. Find these and more at colehaan.com. Our show is produced by Crystal Liguori for radio and podcast. Special thanks to the Literary Arts staff, board, and community. This show would not be possible without them. Thanks also to the band Emancipator for our theme music, and thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another edition of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.